You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, happy 1st of December. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is, it's getting cold here in Washington, D.C. Winter is coming. Wore gloves today for the first time in a long time. Speaking of cold, Herman Cain is feeling the chill. We're going to, as we go through the day, by the way, the Fireside Theater is going to drop in. And on the other end of the spectrum, from, you know, kind of the ridiculous to the sublime, Jan Schakowsky, Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, she's the sublime, is going to. Not that the Fireside Theater is ridiculous. They're humorists. She's going to drop by. Apparently, Eric Prince. Well, I'll let her tell you about that in the next hour. So, anyway, the Herman Cain story. I find this absolutely fascinating, and there's a reason why. First of all, this isn't about, you know, Herman Cain running for president, right? It was never about Herman Cain running for president. Herman Cain was never running for president. Herman Cain doesn't have the ground structure. You know, you look at Mitt Romney's campaign, he actually has people on the ground who are hired staff members in a bunch of states around the country. He's actually running for president. Newt Gingrich may be starting to hire some. But up until this point, he hasn't had them. He's not running, he's kind of the accidental candidate now all of a sudden. But he wasn't running for president. He was running to sell books and to raise his speaking fees, which, as I heard yesterday, $50,000 a whack. Wow. Of course, when he was being a speaker for Fannie Mae, not a lobbyist. No, he would never do lobbying. When he was being a speaker for Fannie Mae, they paid him $1.3 million. Newt was never seriously running for president. Michelle Bachmann spent $11 million getting elected in the House of Representatives in her district in Minnesota, the most of any member of Congress that year. Think about that for a minute. So Michelle Bachmann's not running for president. She's raising money that she can use to run for the House of Representatives so she can hold on to her seat. So, you know, arguably John Huntsman's running for president, but I don't think he has much of a ground game. Ron Paul is seriously running for president as a Republican, and he actually has people out all across the country who have offices for him and working for him. I mean, he's actually seriously running for president. But GOP TV, also known as Fox News, won't take him seriously because he talks about ending wars, which are very profitable to defense contractors and things like that. And he wants to legalize drugs and prostitution. And holy cow, we can't have that. So it kind of leaves Mitt. But back to Herman Cain. Herman Cain, who was not really running for president, is now under attack by his own people for having had a 13-year consensual, apparently loving, extramarital affair. Now, you could argue this is, you know, not kind to his wife. I would certainly argue that. But this, and in some way you could probably build a construct that, in relation to his wife, that was an abusive relationship. But it wasn't an explicitly abusive relationship. On the other hand, what you have with the allegations that are being made against Herman Cain for previous, hang on just a second, for his previous sexual harassment encounters was nothing but defense from the Republicans. So the question that comes to mind is, why is it that Republicans rally behind one of their candidates, in this case Herman Cain, why do they rally behind him when he's accused of sexual harassment, misogyny, essentially, acting, you know, hateful or, you know, using power against women? Why, in the workplace, why do they rally around him when he's accused of that? But when he's accused of having a romantic affair, suddenly they run in the other direction. It's like if he's forcing a woman's head down into his lap, which is one of the things he was, you know, accused of, and settled for $80,000. Here is how the Republicans, clip number five, here's how the head of the Republican Party, Rush Limbaugh, responds to that.
Gloria Allred says her name is Bialik, as in Bialik. There's no R in the name, so you can't say it's Rentalik. It's Bialik.
Right, right. Clip number seven, Ann Coulter, for coming to Herman Cain's defense, again, when he's charged with sexual harassment.
It's outrageous the way liberals treat a black conservative. This is another high-tech lynching. When conservatives accuse someone of sexual harassment, it's true.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the conservative, well, I'll just leave that stand. Here's GOP TV's Kristen Powers on blaming the victim. This is how they responded when Herman Cain was charged with essentially misogyny. Misogyny is a fancy word that means, you know, hating women. Herman Cain was accused of trying to trade sex from women in exchange for jobs, basically. That's what it came down to, sexual harassment. Here it is.
You know, wait, so you got on a train, you went out to dinner. This isn't really what you do when you're looking for a job. Women shouldn't put themselves in these situations. You don't, look, he's a married man. I mean, what is she doing? What is he doing? Going out to dinner, going for drinks, going back to his office. Why are they in the car together?
Yeah, as if nobody has ever looked for a job by going to a friend of a friend and saying, hey, can you help me out? This is not uncommon. You know, the old saying, actually, a very popular saying in this town is it's not what you know, it's who you know. And so that's what was going on. So then it comes out. Then Ginger White comes out and says, you know, for 13 years, she says, you know, I want to defend Herman Cain because he's not this, he hasn't been nasty and abusive towards me and forced me into things. She says, he's, you know, it was consensual. It was fun. He flew me to fancy places and bought me nice gifts. And she says this.
It was a very casual affair. Am I proud to admit to that? No, I'm not. So I went on several trips with Herman. One particular trip was the Mike Tyson Holyfield fight in Las Vegas. You know, I can't make this stuff up. And frankly speaking, I wouldn't want to make this up.
So here's my question. And maybe you can help me noodle this out. You know, riddle this, Batman. Why is it that Republicans support their candidates when they're accused of essentially harming women, you know, threatening them economically in exchange for sexual favors, but they don't support their candidates when their candidates are accused, or anybody else for that matter? I mean, they went after Bill Clinton for the same thing, for a consensual affair in the White House, when their candidates are accused of having a consensual, you know, out of wedlock, yes, but relatively garden variety affair. Why is that so much more horrible than sexual harassment in the minds of the Republican base? And would that be true of the Democratic base? I don't think so, frankly. I think the Democratic base would say sexual harassment, that's a problem. Having an affair, none of my business.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Which opens up even a larger question, which is, you know, what are the things that we really need to know about? I think sexual harassment is in that list. Affairs, no.
We're just learning from Herman Cain himself that a third woman is about to make some serious accusations. What can you tell us about this third woman?
I need a lover that won't call a press conference.
Here we go again.
I need a lover that won't call a press
conference. We're trying to run a campaign. Here we go again.
I need a lover that won't call a press conference.
No, conflict.
I can't control people who are going to make a decision based upon accusations.
Mike and Raleigh did this mashup. This is great. What a hoot. Thank you. Just very quickly, here's, you know, this is what happens when Herman Cain was accused of sexual harassment, a crime against women, for which he settled for $80,000, which is generally considered an admission of guilt, or at least of something. Here's Dick Morris, clip number one.
This is ridiculous. I mean, this woman is in search of money. This woman has been unemployed for 13 years, and this is apparently payday.
It's attack the victim. Here's clip number two, Dick Morris.
You'd have to believe that Herman Cain is a serious, almost imprisonable sexual predator to believe these charges.
Yeah, well, he paid $80,000. Clip number three. Here's Dick Hannity, or Sean Hannity and Dick Morris talking about, you know, and keep in mind, Dick Morris is the guy who was thrown out of the Clinton administration because he hired a hooker and he wanted to suck on her toes, and he paid for it with a check. And the check became public, and the whole thing became public, and so he got bounced out of the Clinton administration. Now, that, again, in this city, and I think pretty much every place else in the United States, hiring a hooker is a crime. You could argue whether or not it's a crime against women, but it's a crime, and that's what Dick Morris was charged with. And so here's Dick being a little odd.
Well, that's always a possibility that she's not going to sue, so it's not going to be a lawsuit.
I look forward to her spread in Playboy.
Yeah, that's Dick Morris. So the question, you know, what is it about the Republican base that embraces this? I just find this fascinating. Jim, it says you're a Newt Gingrich supporter.
Yes, hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm fine. So up? Go ahead.
Well, Gingrich... I don't know Gingrich from the previous years, but I've been listening to him since he started running, and I really like what he has to say. Mm-hmm. But I'm really getting tired. I'm seriously concerned about this tabloid-style tone on both sides of the aisle. We have some serious problems, and we really need a serious debate.
Right.
Let's have a clean debate between the ideas of Gingrich, let's say, if he's the nominee, and the idea of Obama, very clean, without digging dirt and you divorce your wife and the Tiffany account and all that nonsense.
Sure.
And let the people decide. You know, I like this ideology. No, I like this ideology. And let the people vote. But the media is not, on both sides, is not helping this process to stay honest.
No, and Jim, you're being an absolute idealist. First of all, but to the larger question, because the media, you know, if it's about sex, the media is going to talk about it. There's just no way around that. But what I'm curious about is, why do you think that the Republican base says, when one of their candidates is accused of sexual assault or sexual harassment, accused of crimes against women, that the Republican base rallies to their defense to the point of actually attacking the woman repeatedly in national television? Whereas when the candidate is accused of having a loving, consensual affair, suddenly the Republican base wants to turn and run.
Well, I see this kind of indecent bias from both sides of the fence, to be honest. Whether if it happened to be a Republican candidate, then the right media will defend him. If it's a left-wing candidate like this guy Wiener, they attacked him.
Wiener was weird. Wiener was weird, but and he wasn't about having just a normal consensual affair. He was tweeting pictures of yourself to people who you don't know, you know, who might even be kids. I mean, that's weird. But
right.
For example, Jack Kennedy was having sex all over the place. Nobody thought twice about it. Nobody said anything. Teddy Kennedy had apparently a number of affairs. A woman died in his car. I mean, the Democrats kind of shrugged that off. Oh, it's an affair. It's not like he was beating her up, or it's not like he was forcing her to have sex with him in exchange for a job. I don't understand why Republicans would support, you know, and so I think that the Democrats in general have a higher tolerance for the private lives of their candidates, you know, until they become truly bizarre.
How can you say that? How can you say that? The Democrats are attacking Cain on these allegations. before even they're proven. I mean, it's, these attacks are...
I'm not hearing Democrats attacking him on this. I'm hearing Republicans attacking him on it, and that's what I'm confused about. I mean, when it was an allegation of a crime against multiple women, of an actual legal crime, sexual harassment, then all the Republicans were defending Herman Cain. When it was an allegation of something that is not a crime, it is not against the law anymore in the United States, in any state, to the best of my knowledge, to have an affair outside of marriage. And about 60% of men and about 40% of women have done so, married people. That, however, has pushed the Republican electorate over the edge. I don't get it.
But the reason is that, that's what I'm telling you, there's biased, sharp debate in the country on both sides of the aisle, and if we can help get out of it through programs like you. I disagree with your views tremendously, but I respect you because you're sincere about it. But
let's have
sincere disagreements. I mean, let's take Bill Clinton, okay?
Sure.
I'm a conservative, and I love Bill Clinton. I couldn't care less what he did with Monica Lewinsky. I think he was one of the good presidents. So let's have an honest debate.
But let me rephrase that then, Jim. Let's just take Bill Clinton as the example. What if it came out that Bill Clinton had said to Monica Lewinsky, "You're going to do this if you want to keep your job"?
Well, that's against the law, and he has to be punished. But
I would agree with you. But the Republican base wouldn't agree with you if he was a Republican.
I don't agree with bias on both sides of the aisle. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, okay.
I'm saying that
the bias is different on both sides of the aisle, and I'm trying to figure out why. Jim, thank you for the call. Thanks for a thoughtful disagreement and conversation. I appreciate it. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Could it be that the Republican electorate is more tolerant of hierarchy and male domination, and that's why they think sexual harassment's no big deal?
One way or another, I'm gonna find you. I'm gonna get you one way or another. I'm gonna leave you.
Well, it seems like that's what, you know, when Herman Cain had women accusing him of sexual harassment, of crimes against women, his pit bulls, you know, Sean Hannity, going to his defense and going after the women. Here again, clip number four. Here's Sean Hannity.
There's nothing here.
There's nothing.
The lady didn't even work for the company.
Yeah, no, she just wanted a job there, and it was, you do this, you do that. Rush Limbaugh points out in clip number five.
Gloria Allred says her name is Bialik, as in Bialik. There's no R in the name, so you can't say it's Rentalik. It's Bialik.
Now, as soon as it comes out that Herman Cain actually had a loving, consensual affair, and this is not to advocate such, but you know, that as opposed to a power crime, basically. Sean Hannity says this has chipped away at his likability, the affair, and created doubt in people's minds over whether or not, quote, another shoe will drop. Laura Ingraham, campaign seems to have passed Herman Cain by, right? Cain nearly never set up the kind of organization needed to win the Republican presidential nomination. I mean, all of a sudden, they're basically telling the truth about Herman Cain that I've been saying all along, which is that he's not really running for president. Why is it that they back away when it's about this rather than, you know, when it's about having power over women and disrespecting women, they stand behind their man. But when it's about having a consensual, romantic, and sexual, presumably affair, relationship, they no longer stand behind their man. What the hell's going on with the Republican electorate? I don't get it. Ellen in Los Angeles, you have some thoughts on this.
Good morning. I think the power discrepancy remains the same. It's a rich, powerful man who is having a consensual affair, but she's having that with a man who has power, and she remains in her place. And they have no more respect for her or women, and it shows. I don't think the power discrepancy changes just because it's consensual.
Oh, that's interesting. So
I just think it's the same. I mean, I've seen it. I'm aware of it. There's not a lot of respect. Women should know their place. And do you think these women would be with these men if they weren't rich or powerful? They're not that attractive. They're not that bright. They're not that interesting.
Well, you know, the statistics indicate that people who are below the poverty level are just as likely to be having extramarital affairs as people
above the poverty level. Right, but that's not because there's a power issue there.
Right, and that's my point. Issue. We don't know if this woman had this affair with Herman Cain because she was trying to get money or power from him. I mean, a 13-year affair doesn't seem to me like somebody who's trying to get something other than she liked him.
Yes, and he was rich, and he could take her places and do things for her.
Well, yeah. And so you think that that was the basis of her attraction to him?
Yeah, these men are available. They travel. They're out there. And that's an appealing, that's attractive to some women.
Okay. Why did the Republican base drop him like a hot potato when that came out, but not when he was offering to trade sex for jobs?
I'm not really sure of that, but I just don't think they have a lot of respect for women at all.
Yeah.
And the power issue, I think, remains, whether it's consensual or not.
Interesting point, Ellen.
It seems to remain the same.
Okay, interesting point, Ellen. Well made. Thank you very much for the call. Bruce in L.A. Hey, Bruce.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to respond to the gentleman who called in about the Newt Gingrich. You know, he liked Newt Gingrich and whatever. The comments he made were just talking points, and I wish you would have challenged him more on that, because your actual example of Anthony Weiner was a class, you know, that shows the difference. Look how the Democrats responded to that, and look how the Republicans are responding to any of this controversy, as they always do.
Yeah.
Just let it slide, slip it under the table.
Right. I mean, well, you know, I didn't want to get into a debate with him about the actual talking points of what Newt Gingrich is saying on the campaign trail, because that's not the question in my mind. I mean, we do that all day long, and that's you've heard my riffs on most of those things many times. Bob in Homeworth, Ohio. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Tom. I've watched your show for about 4 months now or something like that. Mm-hmm. I find you very interesting, and you bring up a lot of subjects. Okay, now you bring up Reagan. Now, I know this is off subject, all right, but it's on my mind. Now, you talked about Reagan, talking about his secretary, talking about
this. Bob, I really want to stay to this topic and lying to our call screeners. That's great you could get through, but I'll just be right up front. I want to stay to this topic for a while. Carol in Seattle. Hey, Carol, what's up?
I also wanted to comment on the caller who was a Newt Gingrich supporter, mm-hmm. and he started out saying that he really wanted to see an honest debate between Obama and Gingrich, so
right.
you know that you could see the difference in their ideology.
Right.
Well, I mean, ideology is only one part of a candidate or a public servant, and I think there's just too much focus on the ideology. We also have to look at a person's actions and their record of what they've done. Not that you can't forgive people for making a mistake, but it's only a small part. And to me, the whole political campaign, like the Republicans, have managed to make it about ideology as opposed to how that ideology plays out in the real world, in policies, and how it affects people. And to me, I mean, that... Because people don't always stick to their ideology. It's hard.
Sure.
We're human.
Sure. So you're saying that character matters. And I would say that the Republicans really don't want to be talking about character, because when it comes to Mitt Romney, it raises questions of why did he tie his dog to the roof of his car, or it raises questions about his being a Mormon, which I don't have personally a problem with, but a lot of Republicans do. When you're talking about Newt Gingrich, it has to do with, you know, being a serial adulterer and a serial marrier. When it comes to Herman Cain, it has to do with all of this stuff that's coming out. When it comes to Rick Santorum, strange things like bringing home a miscarriage and putting it on the mantle for the kids to look at. I mean, you know, it's just strange character stuff in the Republican Party. Okay, interesting and excellent point. Thank you very much, Carol, for the call. Roberta in Beverly Hills. Hey, Roberta, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You know, I do have a theory on why the right is reacting that way. I don't think that they really believe that sexual harassment exists. They think it's a post-women's movement 1970s rights package that women who are not the right Christian God-fearing married types, who maybe are lesbians and they aren't able to get ahead on their own. Therefore, they find these little rights packages to get money out of rich guys. I think they feel the same way about blacks when it's race discrimination. They don't think it exists, and it's just a game of the system by people that are liberal-leaning.
Right, or they say that it doesn't exist so that they can continue to benefit from it.
Oh, for sure. Oh, for sure. They're totally into it, but they feel entitled to it. And if a woman doesn't like a strange, unappealing man doing hands up her skirt, you know, she's got a problem. She doesn't like being a woman.
Yeah, and here's, to this point, here is Rush Limbaugh. This is from several years ago, but here's Rush Limbaugh on that topic.
I have long told you, for example, Undeniable Truth of Life number 24, written back in 1987, feminism was established so as to allow unattractive women easier access to the mainstream of society. And even to this day, people poo-poo this and say it's insensitive. How could you possibly say something like that? Well, because I mean it, because I believe there's something to it.
See, and basically what he's saying is, you know, how dare women compete with men in the workplace?
Or how they even try to limit our behavior.
Right.
I mean,
right.
If they show up in the workplace, they're still supposed to be getting coffee. And if I come on to a woman, I'm being a man. And if she's backing away from me, you know, she's got to rethink who she is.
Yeah.
I think she's got some issues.
There you go. Okay. Roberta, thank you for the call. Thanks for your thoughts. Liz in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. How about you, Liz?
I just have, you know, I find this very Shakespearean and tragedian.
Yeah, it is, actually.
I see this more as Republicans just feel that they can do no wrong and they're better than we are. They feel like they can get away with this and continue on doing what they're doing because they have all the power. They're the top 1% or whatever, mm-hmm. and they can just, you know, stick by their guy and get away with this, like, mm-hmm. crooks and thieves. I mean, we all saw
you
know, all that stuff happening.
Yeah, and it seems like actually they do that. Liz, thank you very much for sharing that. Christian in Taos, New Mexico. Hey, Christian.
Hi, Tom. It's an honor to be on the phone with you. I think I might have some insight on that. I think that in all the cases where he's being accused of unwanted sexual advances, those cases are easily categorized as a smear campaign or the women are after money or whatever, and you can, the Republican base can set those cases aside, and the net result of setting those aside is that he's still a viable candidate. We can just kind of brush those aside.
Right, that's what we saw. That's what we saw.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden, gee, he fell in love with somebody? Oh, we can't. He's not a viable candidate anymore.
Right, exactly, because that diminishes his moral standing or whatever.
Well, I think it humanizes him, and I think that there's a certain part of the Republican Party that does not want a candidate who's human, that doesn't want a candidate who might have, you know, compassion, although it's not very compassionate to his wife, as I said. I mean, there's a huge caveat that we have to throw in here, but it's different from the normal. I think it's different from the normal. You know, do this and you get this job kind of thing. Thank you, Christian.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So why does the Republican base tolerate misogyny and crimes, but not tolerate good old-fashioned affairs that are not criminal?
Got me running and hiding all over town. Got me sneaking in a beat down.
We'll see. Tracy in El Sobrante listening on Green 960. Hey, Tracy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I have a pretty good idea of why conservatives don't like consensual sex. And I would say that not only does it apply to women getting the kind of action they want from whomever, it also applies to homosexual relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because the basis of the conservative mind is hierarchy and order. And if you are outside of the defined place to get, to do that.
No, I get it. And in fact,
I'm trying not to.
Yeah, no.
I don't want to talk about the wrong thing. You can say sex sexual relations, right?
Sure.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But not any slang.
We can't be too explicit.
I don't think that I'm overstating it to say that if women can go and get whatever they want from whomever they want it, that it's the end of civilization as we know it. That I think they
from the conservative
that.
Point of view.
Yes, yep. From the conservative point of view, yep. This is terrifying. That's why prostitution is not okay, quote, but it really is, because it supports the status quo.
Right, and as long as they can keep it illegal, by the way, they can also keep the women as the criminals.
Right, exactly. If they went after the guys, it's like you said about labor. There aren't illegal aliens working. They're illegal employers.
Correct.
It's the same idea.
Yeah, only they go after the laborers rather than the employers, just like they go after the women rather than the Johns.
Because, again, that supports the power structure that it is. So, and I talked to the conservatives about this, and they say, well, what about your daughter? And I say, yes, she gets to. She isn't at puberty yet, but when she does, I'm working very hard to make sure that she gets to choose to be with whomever she wants.
Yeah.
If you're having an affair, that's between, your partner, your spouse, I guess, and the other person. I have a friend who has an open relationship, and she was talking to another friend about her boyfriend and her husband and how difficult. And her friend is like, oh, that's so terrible. You have to sneak around. It's awful. So sorry for you. And she says, no. My husband knows this guy. He likes him. It's open. Oh, my gosh, that's just awful. Ew.
That would truly make conservatives crazy. Tracy, thank you for sharing. Thank you very much for sharing that. Joe in Detroit. Hey, Joe.
Hey, Tom. I bumped into something over Thanksgiving over my turkey, and I thought of you, and I wanted to call and share it with you. It's so difficult to argue with these right-wing people who have this parallel universe of facts,
mm-hmm.
but I found something from somebody who was at the table who was an AA member.
Right.
And there's an expression in AA called play the movie to the end.
Okay.
And this guy held my uncle accountable when he talked about this right-wing agenda, and he kept saying, okay, well, that's good. Well, let's play the movie to the end. How would you do that?
Oh, in other words, the concept in AA would be if you continue drinking like this, if you continue behaving like this, where are you going to end up? You're going to end up in the gutter dead.
So
what does this have to do with Herman Cain?
Well, all of it, because these people who are ideology-driven have never got to the point, or we've never held them accountable as to, well, how would you do that? What steps would you put in place? So Herman Cain's 999 plan or whatever, you'd say, okay, how would you do that? What would happen?
Security? Yeah, there's never been he's never had a rational explanation for those things. Joe, thank you. Mary Ellen in San Diego. Hey, Mary Ellen, what's up?
I wanted to just give a sociological perspective on why the conservatives would resist the idea of someone having a long-term, loving, committed relationship outside of marriage as over against the kind of dalliances that were happening on the side.
Well, it wasn't dalliances. I'm talking about as opposed to power relationship, money for sex, basically job for sex, power relationship, what I consider to be misogynist, and our crimes, sexual harassment.
Well, I think what they have been inclined to do is take the cases involving alleged sexual harassment and dismiss them as insignificant. They aren't happening as part of his everyday life. They aren't part of mainstream social life. Whereas a long-term relationship, like the one that has been alleged more recently, is more threatening to the stability of the family, to the stability of his marriage.
Mm-hmm.
It's long been seen as not so threatening for a man to go to the red light district and have a little something on the side.
Right.
We kind
in
of
fact, it's decriminalized in most countries.
Consider that as not threatening to the sanctity of marriage or the stability of the family.
I see.
Whereas a long-term committed relationship with the lady next door, with somebody that we can all connect to and say, well, she's not that different from
yeah.
me. Or,
no, you know, in that
else.
Context, it actually makes sense. And that might be a far more rational explanation for why conservatives are freaked out about an affair when they're not freaked out about sexual harassment. That makes perfect sense, Mary Ellen. And causes me to reconsider, you know, my theory that it all had to do with power and domination. But I don't know. It's a last question here, or last opinion here, Ian and Everett. Hey, Ian.
Oh, hi, Tom. Long time, first time. And my point is actually somewhat related to the previous caller, in that I think that it has more to do with plausible deniability.
Mm-hmm.
In that, well, let's see, when...
That he could deny the sexual harassment because it was a short, brief thing, but he couldn't deny the 13-year affair because there's all kinds of evidence of it. Is that what you're saying?
Well, also because...
But he paid $80,000 for that. Go ahead.
Well, it's not so much that. It's that they live in such a top-down world that they believe that everybody who's lower than them wants to get a piece of what they have.
Right. Yeah. And okay, I got it. Got it. Ian, thank you very much for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. In the last hour, well, I'll tell you about that in a few minutes. But right now, when I first saw this story, I thought, what? Is this even possible? You know, I thought it was like one of those kind of Alex Jones stories. But apparently not. And so I wanted to get one of the people that I think is one of the most effective, one of the most progressive, one of the most honorable, and one of my favorite. I mean, just one of the best people in the United States House of Representatives, Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky on the line. And Congresswoman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much.
And I hope it doesn't sound like I'm buttering you up. There's nothing I want.
I love that.
But these are my genuine sentiments, and I think it's appropriate to share them with my listeners.
It's mutual, too.
Well, thank you. I saw this headline, Blackwater CEO Eric Prince tried to intimidate Congresswoman Schakowsky.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, what? So what happened?
Well, they hand-delivered a letter that is the lawyer for Mr. Prince personally, that is not the company. So a representative of his, a lawyer of his, dropped off a letter at our office that essentially, in a number of different ways, it starts out, this firm represents Eric Prince concerning false and defamatory statements you have made against him. And basically threatens me with a lawsuit in this country and abroad.
Now, the abroad part is a little spooky because, as I'm sure you know, there are other, England probably the most conspicuous example. They have libel laws there that where public figures don't have immunity like they do here in the United States.
Right.
And Eric Prince has a lot of money.
Eric Prince does have a lot of money, but the very idea that he would threaten a member of Congress into silence, that, of course, was the goal.
Mm-hmm.
It is just not acceptable to me. The kinds of questions that I've raised about Mr. Prince and Blackwater as a member of Congress, through legislation and about other companies as well. You know, I introduced legislation that would stop outsourcing our security. That's the name of the bill, the SOS bill.
Right.
It says that we should not rely on mercenary companies, private for-profit companies, to carry out the most sensitive missions of war or in any kind of a conflict zone.
Mm-hmm.
But I said that, of all the companies that did that kind of work, that the one most notorious for misconduct has been Blackwater, and that's just a fact, and I intend, whenever it's appropriate, to keep saying that.
Now, Blackwater no longer exists. It's now XE or Z, right?
It's Z.
Okay. And didn't they move their base of operations outside the United States?
No, Z, I believe, is still in the United States. Mr. Prince, though still a U.S. citizen, I understand, has moved to Dubai. Mm-hmm. He has been involved in the marketing of a game, a video game called Blackwater. I don't know if he personally is involved in going to be marketing Blackwater in other ways, but there's a video game.
That's interesting. So the video game glorifies
Blackwater. Not to Dubai. I'm sorry. He moved to the UAE.
To the United Arab Emirates, yeah. Which, by the way, leads to our geeky science alert, which I'm going to get into after the break. We have this. This was studied. This was presented at the November 30th annual meeting of the Radiological Society of North America. For the first time, fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, analysis of long-term effects of violent video games on the brain has shown changes in brain regions associated with cognitive function and emotional control. Anyhow, we'll get into that. Yeah.
Well, okay, there you go.
So we will get into that later. But so what is it that Mr. Prince is trying to shut you up about?
Well, he mentions quite specifically that I have gone to the Secretary of State. I raised concerns that Mr. Prince is now exporting his services because there was a report in the New York Times that now he may be assembling a kind of mercenary army, which he denies that allegation, but nonetheless, I wanted the Department of State to take a look at that. I have, he says, had a multi-year history of making derogatory comments about Mr. Prince and his former company. But as I mentioned in the statement that I made on the floor, there is a long list of alleged misconduct, from shooting and killing civilians to gun running. We've got four former Blackwater executives, including his former vice president, Gary Jackson, indicted in 2010 for weapons charges. The company has agreed to a $42 million administrative settlement with the State Department for 288 alleged violations of the Arms Export Control Act and International Traffic in Arms Regulations. There's seven civil suits that were settled. And legal action still pending against four Blackwater guards accused, as you may remember, of massacring 17 civilians in Baghdad's Nisr Square in 2007. Iraq said they had to be ousted, and the U.S. State Department refused to renew their contract. So this is the idea that we've got these mercenaries who are in a legal limbo, unclear to what extent they can be prosecuted for misconduct. And even former Defense Secretary Robert Gates in 2007 stated that the mission of many security contractors was, and I quote, at cross purposes to our larger mission in Iraq, unquote. And yet we're spending, Blackwater alone had about $1.25 billion in contracts.
Right. So I'm curious what you're going to do with this. For example, Bill Clinton and I did a fundraiser for Congressman Jim McDermott about 3 years ago in Seattle to help raise $300,000 for his legal fees because he was being sued by Newt Gingrich.
Right.
It can cost money when you get sued.
Yeah, I don't know that they'll actually sue, but I wanted to. This was my response to their letter that if they thought that this was going to be successful and actually shutting me up and stopping my work, because I think this is one of the most important questions right now. That we haven't asked. You know, the use of these private military contractors, which has the potential and in some cases the reality of compromising our mission and the safety of our troops and the morale of our troops and costing lots and lots of money, that what is their role in in wars. It's an important question right now because as we remove our troops, our uniformed military, what role are private security contractors going to play? We never count them. When people, you know, you hear about, we've heard over these years now about surges, but never counted are how many contractors are there actually.
Right. So this needs to be brought out into the light. I think so. I am so with you. And I'm so curious about their role in New Orleans after Katrina, but that's
another one.
You know, it's like.
Exactly.
You know, yeah.
They were down there, you know, with loaded weapons and, you know, so, you know, this company in particular, but we've had the Armor Group with this kind of sexual hazing. We saw these pictures. Anyway, it's a lot of them, but especially Blackwater.
Very, very interesting. Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, schakowsky.house.gov, ably representing the 9th District of Illinois. Congresswoman, please keep us informed on how this is going.
Will do. Thanks,
Tom. And keep up the great work in the House of Representatives.
And you keep up the good work.
I'll do my very best. Thank you so much for being with us today.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I wonder if this ties into the whole Herman Cain thing. You're, you know, a powerful man threatening a woman.
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school. And proud.
Well, some of us did. I actually didn't. But other than science class, I remember Miss Emmer's biology class in the 8th grade was the best class I ever took in my whole entire life. And just, in any case. It's our Geeky Science Alert. Just a very brief one, then we'll pick up your calls and get into some of the other news of the day. But this is my opportunity to share with you my favorite science news story of the day. This is from Science Daily. And this went to the Supreme Court in 2010, last year. Should violence in video games be allowed, or should it be restrictable like pornography is? And at that point in time, there was no scientific evidence that violent video games produced any bad outcomes. I mean, they couldn't associate violent video games with, for example, people committing crimes. Nobody had done the research. So somebody did. And this was the co-authors Tom Hummer, William Cronenberger, Christine Mosier, Vincent Matthews, blah, 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 blah. Research. What they did is they took two groups of young men, ages 18 to 29. So we're not talking about kids here who have very plastic and impressionable brains. We're talking about young men, 18 to 29, two groups, healthy adult males. Randomly assigned them to two groups. One group had to spend 10 hours a day at home for 1 week playing violent video games, and the other group just spent their lives and did not play any video games. And they did functional magnetic resonance imaging, the fMRI. It's a way of looking inside the brain and looking at the soft tissue structures of the brain to see what's going on inside the brain. Right, in terms of actual physical changes in the brain, as well as brain function. And what they found, an fMRI analysis of long-term effects, what they found is that just that 1 week, 10 hours a day, 1 week, of playing violent video games produced long-term and perhaps permanent, I mean, we won't know until they go back 10, 20, 30 years from now and do another fMRI of these young people, in the brain regions associated with cognitive function and emotional control. Yang Wang, MD, the assistant research professor at the Department of Radiology and Imaging Sciences at Indiana State University of Medicine in Indianapolis, where the study was conducted, said, for the first time, we have found that that a sample of randomly assigned young adults showed less activation in certain frontal brain regions, that's where thinking and regulation of behavior is, following a week of playing video games at home. These brain regions are important for controlling emotion and aggressive behavior. They looked at them at the end of 1 week, and then they looked at them at the end of 2 weeks. With the second week, they didn't play the violent video games. And the conclusion that they came to was that, well, after 1 week of violent video play game, the video game members showed less activation in the left anterior frontal lobe during the emotional task, less activation in the anterior cingulate, if I'm pronouncing it right, cortex during the counting task. In other words, it decreased cognitive function, thinking, and it decreased emotional regulation. Not good. Which raises another question, and he said these findings indicate that violent video game play has a long-term effect on brain functioning. Okay. So that raises in my mind a second question, which is if playing a violent video game for 10 hours changes your brain permanently, what about going off to war in Iraq where it's 24/7 for a year? Or any war for that matter. I mean, isn't this the beginning of some sort of like really strong evidence that we should just declare war mass insanity and end it forever? Or at the very least, do everything possible to avoid it, unlike George W. Bush, who just so eagerly, him and, you know, draft dodger Dick Cheney, oh boy, let's have a war. When the one guy who'd actually seen war, Colin Powell, was going, wait a minute, guys. So, anyway, just some thoughts. Mike in Robinson, Illinois. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom, you got a great program there. I appreciate it.
Thank you. What's on your mind?
First a comment and then a question. My comment is you know, man by nature is corrupt and has, you know, indiscretions. We don't have an answer for you know, corruption in the government. We've had corruption throughout mankind, you know what I mean?
Arguably, yeah.
So, my question is, which this kind of tends to lead to corruption, but my question is, what do you think about a flat tax and universal health care? And I mean those combined together.
Right.
If you make $1,000, you pay 10%.
Yeah, I'm opposed to flat tax because if somebody's making $1,000 a month and they're making $10,000 a year, I don't think that I know that they can't afford to live on that. And if somebody is making $1,000 a minute, as some people on Wall Street are, then they can certainly afford to pay a hell of a lot more than 10%. And of course I'm in favor of universal health care, but the main reason for a progressive income tax that says after you make $1 million a year, then after that, up until that point, you pay 20, 30, 40%, but after that, you start paying more than 70%. In other words, rolling back the Reagan tax cut is that you can go back through our tax code over the last 100 years and you can see this. Whenever the tax code, whenever the top tax on the millionaires and billionaires is above 50%, you don't have bubbles in your economy. When it drops below 50%, those people get all that hot money and they start gambling it like crazy, you know, in the markets places, and you end up with bubbles. And we've had basically a bubble economy ever since Reagan dropped the top tax rate from 74% down to 28%. We have had nothing but bubbles. And I would add to that the capitalist gains tax being at 15%. I mean, right now, the half of all the income of the top one-tenth of 1% of Americans comes from capital gains. So they're paying a maximum 15% income tax. Well, of course we have a bubble economy. So that's the reason.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We will be back. Why is Herman Cain's affair worse than sexual assault? Still scratching my head.
Come on. Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me.
Apparently slightly unbalanced. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Oh, our cheesy news alert, courtesy of Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. GOP presidential frontrunner Newt Gingrich today vowed that his days of infidelity were behind him, telling an audience in Iowa, "I've screwed all the women I want. All that's left is America." Mr. Gingrich added that as president, quote, "I will be 100% faithful to the United States of America unless, of course, it gets cancer or something," end quote. He always scoffed at rival Mitt Romney's attempts to portray himself as a happily married family man. He said the only reason Mitt Romney hasn't had any sex scandals is that he keeps changing positions. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. No, it's not actually like that. So the question. And there's a lot of other things going on in the world, by the way. You know, and Jan Schakowsky being harassed by Blackwater, I think that's of significance. We've covered a number of things on the news. In fact, let me just dig out my list here. I want to just quickly touch on a couple of these. This is actually one one of the most important things that's going on is this program that is tragically named a lie heap, which sounds like lying doesn't sound good, and heaps, you know, but that's how Democrats name things. Instead of calling it the Clear Skies Initiative or the Save Our Seniors or, you know, Help People Stay Warm bill, it's called LIHEAP. It's an acronym. It stands for Low Income Heating Assistance Program. And this program has been cut almost in half over the last few years by Republican budgets. And the price of oil is up substantially. And about a quarter of people in the Northeast, you know, Vermont, Hampshire, Maine, Massachusetts, New York, about a quarter of those people heat their homes with oil. And the poor people among them pay for that oil through the LIHEAP program. It's going to be a really, really cold winter. Bernie Sanders is one of the guys responsible for the LIHEAP program. I'm sure he'll have something to say about that tomorrow on the program when we do brunch with Bernie. And this I thought was fascinating. They've actually done a study to find out what is the effect of different types of government spending. What they found was that $1 billion spent on military spending will produce roughly 11,000 jobs, but $1 billion spent on education creates 26,700 jobs. So every $1 billion that you spend on the military, you're losing 15,000 jobs from what you could have had if you spent it on other domestic things. Why is that? Well, it just makes a certain amount of sense. If what you're doing is you're building things to drop on other people and they blow up and go away and that's the end of it, then that's stupid. It's not productive. If you're building a bridge, if you're building a school, if you're investing in the intellectual infrastructure of the nation, not only are you employing more people to do it, not only is it a good activity, but it also has a positive byproduct of producing revenue and income for the country for years and years and years. So anyhow, Jeannie in Ithaca, New York, back to Herman Cain. Jeannie in Ithaca, New York, what's up?
Yes. Well, I was a sexually abused young woman. I'm now 62. And everyone who abused me is not punished. So I think this is why, Tom, while they're abusing you, you've already been preconditioned to believe they have the right. And so many people respect them, you're afraid no one will believe you, and so you say nothing. As the years go on, you have nightmares and cold sweats and sexual impotence or nymphomania, and you're tired of suffering emotionally or suffering female problems for the damage. So you tell somebody, and they turn against you or believe you. But in my experience, everyone has turned against me, including my own family, so I'm alone. And then the predators go on to fame, fortune, legend, most repugnantly, profit. So in the case of Herman Cain, for me, he fits totally the perfect profile of an abuser. He's in love with himself. Of course, this is a facade. He hates himself because with every abuse, he hurts his own soul. But in the case of the Republican Party, they're a misogynist group, as you say. The same people who burned the homeopathic female physicians of Salem, who held the secrets of birth control and breech birth and cesarean surgery, secrets have been lost, but which these women had retained and saved our sisters' lives.
Yes.
Republicans, I think, are women haters, and the saddest trend is that they have brainwashed their own women into hating their own sisters. It's my belief that they do this to preserve their own manhood, which they gravely doubt. It's expressed in overgrown phallic weapons and secret pedophilia, harassment, rape, such, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Until they're exposed as a group, which I remind everybody has never happened in the history of this planet. I don't think we can hope for a true democracy because, as you know, per your research, which I've read, the social groups who are most true to democratic systems are the groups which give their women an equal voice. So
yes.
I think Democrats have a much more realistic view of women as equals, and so they appreciate their consent in a sexual relationship, and I think that's why Republicans have the problem with it. I refer you to Alphabet versus the Goddess.
Yes, Leonard Schlein's book.
Yes.
It's absolutely brilliant.
Yes, it is, and I urge everyone to read it. I saw you in Ithaca. You signed a book for me. I treasure it as a gem of your exceptional political, social, and planetary mind, so I thank you.
Well, thank you, Jeannie, and thank you. Thanks for your kind words, and I think you're spot on everything you said. Thank you very much for calling. Barbara in Fresno. Hey, Barbara, what's up?
Well, I was just going to comment on the same thing. There's obviously a double standard, and I guess right-wing men are assumed to be moral, have moral rectitude by default. And if you question that, somehow that's just, it's not, I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't understand
is it,
either, really.
Why is it that, for example, David Vitter is having sex with prostitutes? He gets caught. And he goes back to a standing ovation from his colleagues and gets reelected to his Senate seat. Eliot Spitzer has sex with a prostitute. He gets caught. He resigns as governor of New York. Spitzer's a Democrat. Vitter's a Republican. It seems almost like these are people living in different moral systems. And then again with Herman Cain, when he is accused of crimes against women, all the Republicans come out and defend him. Sean Hannity's defending him. Rush Limbaugh's defending him. Ann Coulter's defending him. When he is accused of having a relationship as opposed to committing a crime, then all of a sudden they abandon him. You know, what's going on in their heads? This seems to me like misogyny.
Well, yeah, I guess I don't know any more than anybody else. I was kind of calling to, see what other callers had said previously.
Okay, great. Barbara, thank you for your contribution. I appreciate the call. Milton in Ono, West Virginia. Hey, Milton, what's up? Milton?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, what's on your mind?
I was calling about, I'm a veteran during the Vietnam era.
Mm-hmm.
And, when they had the Veteran Day, all the media shows, they bring people on, to talk about how to celebrate the veterans. But did you ever watch and notice that they bring the generals on to talk to them instead of bringing the soldiers, the ones that do the dying and gets injured and stuff? Why don't they? Well, how come don't they think that the normal people are the one that they need to talk to, or all of them just so up in the sky that they don't understand the way people are?
Well, I don't think it's that. I think that the way that Washington, D.C. works, the way that power works, is that the generals are the ones, basically if you become a general or its equivalent in any of the armed services, when you retire, you can get a job with a defense contractor that's going to pay a lot more than you ever made in the military. And that's just out there. It's an open secret. And all the defense contract is like it's like the retirement program for these guys. And so, therefore, what they're going to say is going to play into the power narrative and the money narrative of the military-industrial complex, military-industrial media complex, military-industrial media congressional, fill in the blanks. It's becoming all pervasive. And that's why I think that they bring the generals out. If you brought a bunch of GIs out who are not going to be able to get $1 million a year job with a defense contractor when they leave, heaven only knows what they would say. And that unpredictability is not what they want. So that's my theory, Milton. Thanks a lot for the call. Ed in Robinson, Texas. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hello. Yes, how you doing, Tom?
Fine.
I want to answer your question on Herman Cain, and I voted for Jimmy Carter, and I liked him, and he brought about the Camp David Accord, and Mubarak has been a friend of ours for so many years up till now, and they took him out just recently, and Obama was for that, getting rid of him, and we weren't under attack. But I will get the Herman Cain thing. Is one thing. It's I want a moral man and as my president, whether he be Democrat, Republican, or independent. I want a man that has high moral standards. And I know you're not allowed to say this. I want a man with maybe biblical principles. And even if there wasn't a God, the Bible has good rules for a man to live by. Ten Commandments are good rules.
You mean like stone your children if they disrespect you?
No. Well, that's Old Testament.
You just said the Ten Commandments. I mean, that's, kill somebody who worships a God different than yours. That's the first commandment.
Okay. But anyway.
But to your point, Ed, I personally think that Jimmy Carter was one of the best presidents of the 20th century, and he was one of the only presidents under which there was the United States was engaged in no military hostilities. And
right,
I think he was a very, very good man, and I think he was prescient. He saw the energy crisis coming. I mean, this guy was a nuclear engineer. He understood energy. And he was a good man. But I would say, if we want to talk about morality, Jimmy Carter was probably also the only president in the 20th century who never had an affair with anybody. But beyond that, he was the only president, as I said, who wasn't out killing people. And I think that those are both dimensions of morality. And that's something that we need to be looking at, is the morality of war, the morality of violence in this country.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour, we're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service to find out what's going on in D.C. and around the world.
Hey, I put some new shoes on and suddenly everything's right. I said, hey, I put some new shoes on and everybody's smiling. It's so inviting, though. Short on money, but long on time. Slowly showing in the sweet sunshine and I'm running.
Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, on the line with us. Victoria, welcome.
Thank you very much.
You did a brilliant job yesterday describing what was going on in the UK. And,
thank you.
And what's the follow-up to that?
Well, basically the follow-up is that, you know, the talks are just not going well, and the government of David Cameron is not yielding. But the workers are absolutely definite that they will continue. I don't know at this point. I hope to know more later in the day from one or two people I'm going to talk to whether they intend further action.
So yesterday we had 2 million people out in the streets. They basically shut down the UK or large chunks of it.
And they really did. I mean, the streets were very quiet.
Yeah. Remarkable. So what
yeah.
else? So I'm sorry. I started. I defined your first news story, and you should be doing that. What do you see as the important news of the day? I see that you're in the White House.
No, I'm actually not.
I'm in my
own bunker.
Okay, you're in the Victoria bunker.
The Victoria bunker.
So what's up?
The ACLU says today that the FBI is using its extensive community outreach to Muslims and other groups to secretly gather intelligence in violation of federal law. Now, they today are citing internal bureau documents, and they say that agents in California are attending meetings at mosques and other events, even kebab lunches and things, and illegally recording information about the attendees' political and religious affiliations, social security numbers. FBI officials are denying the allegations and saying records kept from outreach sessions are not used for investigations, they're used internally. Now, some of the papers show agents speaking at career days and things like that. But some of them say things like one attendee is described as very progressive, another is called very Western in outlook and appearance. But the FBI is saying, look, these documents violate the Privacy Act, a law that bars federal agencies from maintaining information about activities protected by the First Amendment. FBI officials are saying the law allows agencies to keep information that's considered relevant and necessary to their mission. Furthermore, they say, interestingly, that these documents are being kept for internal purposes to ensure that personnel time and resources are being used effectively and in compliance with applicable laws, regulations, policies, and program requirements.
So where's this going to go? I mean, is this an ACLU complaint, or is this a lawsuit, or is this
a... This is a lawsuit. They have sued the Bureau in four states and are seeking FBI files nationwide under the Freedom of Information Act.
And under discovery, rules of discovery, I would assume, if there's a lawsuit.
Right. There is a lawsuit. I mean, they have sued, and they have made this allegation today. They have got these documents, and they are internal bureau documents. However, many of them are heavily redacted.
Of course.
So even though they've got some information, some of it is difficult to know exactly what's happened.
Right. So this is something to keep an eye on.
Oh, definitely something to keep an eye on. I mean, the FBI is really very much saying that these meetings with community leaders are not designed to gather intelligence, but rather to enhance public trust in the FBI in order to enlist the cooperation of the public to fight criminal activity. However, some of the Muslim leaders who found out about this are saying that this is a violation of our trust.
Right.
I mean, they found out things like, for example, notations that the Assyrian language is very similar to ancient Aramaic, making notes like that after contacts with the Assyrian organizations in San Jose. So just things like that.
Yeah, that's just like odd. That's the kind of thing that some fundamentalist Christian who wants a Bible translated from Aramaic to English instead of Greek to English might find fascinating. But that's puzzling to me. But in any case, what else is going on in the world?
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is on a historic visit to Myanmar, also known as Burma today, met for the first time today with the acclaimed leader of its opposition movement, Nobel laureate, and announced that the U.S. is going to loosen some restrictions on financial aid to reward Myanmar's nascent political and economic restructuring.
Well,
the U.S. and Myanmar also agreed to discuss the possibility of upgrading diplomatic relations and exchanging ambassadors.
What do you think the odds are that a year from now or 2 years from now, Aung San Suu Kyi will be the prime minister or president of Myanmar, and maybe they'll even be change their name back to Burma?
I think that if this whole thing doesn't go completely pear-shaped, which is possible, I think the odds are very good. She has enormous support in the country.
What does completely pear-shaped mean? Is that
it's an English expression for going absolutely wrong.
I see.
Going downhill fast.
Right. Okay.
Then she met Ken Sen, the president, at the monumental presidential palace in Naypyidaw, the city erected only 6 years ago amid remote farmlands about 200 miles north of the country's main city, Yangon, which used to be called Rangoon. Now, this is considered very odd that they built this capital city 200 miles away, sort of in the jungle. Nobody lives there except diplomats and people who work for them. In fact, the workers commute from their homes to work there. There's nobody there. There's incredible malls. There's movie theaters. Nobody lives there.
Very strange.
Many people don't even know about it. It's very strange. And people are asking, why did he build it?
Yeah.
And one of the theories is that he was told to by an astrologer.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah,
there's a country.
And that's a major theory.
Yeah, there's a country in South or Central. It's one up from Costa Rica that has done something very similar to that, only not quite so severe. But they built a out of scratch in the jungle. I'm trying to remember the name of the country. Louise and I have been there. In fact, we spent the day there with Rachel Maddow a couple of years ago. But in any case, the Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
And Talk Radio News Service brought to you by the new book, Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You know, there was a time in this country when the Jetsons were just emerging, the cartoon characters, the future. Everybody was talking about the future. This was back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And there was a very interesting dialogue that was going on in the United States. We had seen in this country, and you can find graphs of this. The Center for American Progress did a great chart of this over at the Think Progress blog a few months ago. We had seen productivity, per-person productivity in the United States, steadily increase in the founding of this country. Per-person productivity jumped up, for example, when the cotton gin was invented in the early 19th century. It jumped up again when steam engines became, you know, the leading edge of the Industrial Revolution around the time of the Civil War. And it jumped up again as, you know, after Colonel Titus drilled his first oil well in Titusville, Pennsylvania in 1867. And throughout the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s, as the Industrial Revolution moved from steam to internal combustion engines, and Mr. Diesel's product came out, and we started lighting with kerosene. And then it jumped again in the early 20th century as kerosene lights and gas lights were replaced by electric lights, and America was electrified, and electrical appliances came about. And throughout all, and right up until the 1960s, 70s, and the early 80s, what we had seen literally from the days of George Washington until the inauguration of Ronald Reagan was that the cost of labor, in other words, wages, and productivity tracked each other. As productivity went up, even if it went up because of the invention of the steam engine, even if it went up because of the invention of oil-based, you know, of internal combustion engines, regardless of, even if productivity went up because of, you know, washing machines instead of hand launderers. Yes, there were dislocations. Industries changed. The buggy whip industry famously went out of business. It was replaced by the auto industry. But throughout this whole period of time, from the founding of our country until Reagan's presidency, as productivity went up, so did wages. So what people were seeing in the 60s and 70s and early 80s was that productivity was about to make another massive leap forward. Now, with every one of the prior leaps forward, what had happened was leisure time increased. People back in the, you know, in the early years of this republic, outside of the wealthy planters and things, but the average working person typically was working a 6 or 7 day week and in a 10 or 12 hour day. And that was pretty much the norm up until the middle of the 19th century. In fact, you could argue that that was the norm up until the progressive era around the 1910s. And then people started working 6 day weeks or 5 day weeks. And in fact, the 5 day week became standardized by the mid 1930s. And originally it was the 50 hour week, Teddy Roosevelt's 50 hour week. That became Franklin Roosevelt's 40 hour week, which meant that people had more leisure time. They had more time to spend with their family, more time to spend with their friends, more time to write poetry, more time to paint, more time to invent things, to tinker in their garage like Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs did on the weekends and build things, invent things, create things. More leisure time. And the speculation, Jeffrey Dumazider, in 1967, he was able to proclaim a great historical inversion. In the year 1967, for the first time in American history, the average American worker spent more time in what is called leisure time, in other words, more time at home when he wasn't or she wasn't sleeping, than at work. That was the peak, 1967. And at that point, everybody was looking at these trends and saying, okay, if this trend continues, productivity continues to increase, wages continue to track productivity, and people at some point say, you know, instead of extra wages, I'll take a 4 day work week. Or I'll take a 30 hour week instead of a 40 hour week, because we'd already gone from a 50 hour week to a 40 hour week in the 20th century. And in the 19th century, we've gone from a 60 hour week to a 50 hour week. So we were down to a 40-hour week in 1967. And there were all these articles being written, and those of you old enough to remember this know what I'm talking about. Those of you who did not consciously live through the 60s, 70s, or early 80s, trust me on this. You can easily find this stuff, although a lot of it isn't as easily Googleable. You'd have to, because the Internet didn't exist at that time. So you'd have to go back and buy Life magazines from the 60s and 70s. But there was this huge dialogue in America about the coming leisure society. So the question I'd like to ask for this hour, among all the other things that we could be talking about, after we hear from our friends at the Fireside Theater, the question I'd like to ask is, what would America be like if wages had continued to track productivity? Now, here's what actually happened. because we were heading for 30-hour work week. I mean, France went to a 35-hour work week in the 60s, or in the 70s, actually, and which is the direction that we were heading. But if you look at that graph, what you find is two really interesting things happened with the election of Ronald Reagan. One was that productivity continued to increase, and the line is fairly linear. I mean, all the way from George Washington right up to today, productivity has continuously increased on a per capita basis, per worker. But wages, which had, from the George Washington administration through the Jimmy Carter administration, had always increased at the same speed at which productivity increased, wages suddenly flattened out with the Reagan administration, and they have stayed flat for 30 years. So here's this huge gap, this yawning chasm that has opened up now, 30 years later, between flattened out wages and rising productivity. You can imagine these two lines. One is horizontal now. They used to be both going up, you know, at an angle, like an incline going up a hill. They did that from 1870 to 1981. And then suddenly wages flattened out and productivity continued to increase. So in that gap was all this extra wealth or all this spare time, all this leisure time. Where did it go? Well, it turns out that from the time Reagan became president until today, the top 1%, well, the bottom 90%, well, the bottom 80% have seen an 18% increase in their wages overall. The top 1% have seen a 257% increase in their wages. In other words, you didn't get that leisure time that everybody was talking about in the 60s and 70s that was coming, because the very, very rich took the money. The system got rigged. The Reagan administration and Reaganomics rigged the system to deny Americans leisure time. And it's reached the point now where not only are people no longer working 40-hour weeks like they were at that peak in 1967, but they're working 50-hour weeks and 60-hour weeks and 70-hour weeks. They're working two jobs, three jobs. Two, three, four people in the household are working in order to keep the household intact. And the top 1% are doing better than they have ever done before. I mean, in the history of the country, maybe in the history of the world. So what would America be like if the 1% hadn't gamed the system? And we had all seen the results of those increases in productivity.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
What kind of an America can you envision in a world where people are actually paid for what they produce?
Back from the shadows again. Out where an engine's your friend, where the vegetables are green and you can pee into the stream. Yes, we're back from the shadows again.
One of my all-time favorite songs. I've been singing it ever since I was 16 years old. David Osmond, Phil Osmond. Osmond, Phil Austin, Peter Bergman, Phil Proctor of the Firesign Theater, firesigntheater.com. On the line with us. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
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 I think we're all bozos on this bus. Particularly for our KPOJ listeners, the Firesign Theater will be in Portland, Oregon at the Winningstad Theater, the Portland Arts Center, on Friday and Saturday, December 9th and 10th. Tickets are available via Ticketmaster. And you guys have been purveying fine surrealism. I didn't even know that was a word for 40 years. It's just absolutely great. So I'm not even sure where to begin.
I can tell you this, Tom, there's so much hot air blowing around Southern California today. It feels like we're in Washington with you.
Okay. Except, thank you.
Bananas come into town. It's terrible.
Yeah, except that it's cold here. But the hot air is pretty amazing. So, what do we do with this? You've been hearing my rants here, and I don't know if you have some funny comments about what we can do to get back our leisure society.
Well,
go ahead. Wait, let's all talk over each other.
Yeah, that's what
everybody
we do
at once.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. No, wait. My bucket is full. I had peed this bucket, but now it's full. What do I do now? Oh, I'll pee on the pizza.
That's the end of the filibuster.
Pictures of it.
There we go. Okay, well, what I could do is I could call on Phil. Then you talk over each other.
Yeah. Go ahead. Nick Danger, okay. You know everything.
Nick Danger, please.
Oh, okay. Okay, let me fall into that voice. Yes, Tom, I don't even know who I am, much less who Ronald Reagan is.
Okay, so who are the villains and who are the good guys?
The villains right now seem to me, it's sad about the 0.08% or something like that. I'm feeling sorry for them because now evidently they have so much damn leisure time that they probably just sit around and watch Country Music Channel, probably on TV. That's all they've got now.
I think it must be. Is Artie Choke around?
Artie Choke?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Artie?
Yeah, well, I've got a slightly different take on it. You know, I just returned from the 99% store.
Uh-huh.
Where I get all of my good for the upcoming change. And all I know is that I think, you know, this is the beginning of the end of the corporate state, Tom. What do you think?
I think it's conceivable, and I think it would be pretty amazing. General, are you there, and might it have something to do with the eggs?
Yeah, oh, well, yes, of course. It's in everybody's eggs, except only 99% of everybody is getting an egg, and that's all they're getting. You understand what I'm saying? And there are aliens in those eggs, so we have to be afraid of just about everything that we touch or handle or want to smoke or, you know, it's a terrible thing.
And
it's a dangerous time, and as we enter the holiday season, it looks more and more like Newt is the Gingrich that stole Christmas.
well said. Is Nick Tirebiter around?
Now you're going to get everybody at once.
Firebiter.
I'm going to pepper spray my way through to talk.
Okay. Go for it.
You see that at Walmart 2 or 3 days ago, they stepped over a dying man to get to the discounted Xboxes?
Yeah.
The guy was having a heart attack, and until a couple of nurses noticed that he was dying, everybody was just walking over him to get to the Xboxes.
Can you put a body into an Xbox? I don't know.
Yeah. He was an ex-guy.
He was an ex-guy. Sure, he needs an Xbox.
Mm-hmm. So
here's a factoid from Washington State that I think is very pertinent to this. I just heard this morning. Sitting in the coffee shop, guy says, that he's on food stamps. So he called up the Department of Health and Human Services to get some information about what he should do to get on food stamps or continue or whatever. And his call was answered by a call answering service in India.
Right.
What does that tell you?
David, was he using the food stamps to buy coffee?
that's the only way he can stay awake long enough to call India to find out how to get more.
This is a guy who climbs trees. He's a tree cutter down. Not a tree cutter downer, but, you know, a tree trimmer guy. And so he's up there with coffee nerves very high up in a cedar tree.
Honest to God, this is the kind of material you're going to get if you come to our show. Because we have lines that we have memorized and some that we create on the spur of the moment.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
So. Has anyone got another bucket?
just go up to the cloud and create one. Did you see that bumper sticker, I lost my job and somebody found it in India? I think that kind of like explains what's going on. The show, let me give you a quick idea of what we're doing.
Sure, yeah, because we have about 50 seconds.
All right, it's basically called I Think We're All Bozos on This Bus.
Mm-hmm.
This is the Firesign Theater's 45th anniversary. Bozos was released in 71. It's still completely relevant. We do it. We do pieces from our Shakespeare parody called Anything You Want To, which is now out as a book. And then we do a whole lot of other stuff just to make you laugh. Nick Danger returns. Contemporary stuff, all of that. We're only in it for the laughs, by the way. If it's a matter of relevance or laughs, laughs first.
That's great. And you guys are going beyond just Portland, right? I mean, I announced the Portland Arts Center on December 9th and 10th, Saturday, Friday, and Saturday. Tickets available at Ticketmaster. But you're doing this. I think we're all Bozos in this bus and other places as well.
Yes, we're thinking of an L.A. date, but we're also putting together a national webcast. because the cool. only way for us to tour the so-called flyover, and even the East Coast right now, is to get to people via the web, you know, like a web concert.
There you go.
We're into that. We'll let you know.
Yeah,
hey,
and
Tom,
yeah.
people can go to firesigntheater.com.
Yes, and I was just going to say
so
that.
Thank you so much.
Firesigntheater.com is where, and it's S-I-G-N, firesigntheater.com, and you can find the whole thing there. And David, Phil, Peter, Phil, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank
Good
you,
luck,
Tom.
Guys.
We love you.
You're
our greatest fans. Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Coming up, the good, the bad, and the incredibly vocabulary word ugly, and your calls. Yep, that would be the good, the bad, and the very, very susilically ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com. The good. Senator Tom Harkin, the Democrat from Iowa, is telling his fellow members of Congress to hold off on making plans for Christmas, at least until they do something for the millions of unemployed Americans and pass an extension of unemployment benefits. The current extension of benefits is set to expire at the end of this month. And Harkin said, let me put it this way. There will be no Christmas for Congress unless there is an extension of the unemployment insurance benefits. Harkin went on to say, I hate to inform my Republican colleagues, but Wall Street did not build America. When it comes to handing out hundreds of millions of dollars, Wall Street is in front. It's time for middle-class America to be up front. Well said. Let's see if Republicans do the right thing if their vacation depends upon it. Excuse me. The bad. Apple. Earlier this week, news broke that Apple's newest iPhone feature, known as Siri, a voice assistant that helps users find information they need, appears to have a bias against helping women find abortion services, often giving women misinformation on where the nearest clinics are. Apple responded to the controversy, saying that the wrong information provided by Siri was not intentional and that kinks are still being worked out in the technology. That doesn't explain why Siri directs women to right-wing crisis pregnancy centers instead of actual abortion clinics, and why Siri has a much easier time locating escort services and gun shops than emergency rape centers or contraceptive services. It appears as though the war on women has gone digital. And the very, very ugly, Jeremy Clarkson. Clarkson is the host of the BBC's most popular TV show, known as Top Gear, a show primarily about cars. But yesterday, Clarkson went out of his area of expertise to talk about the massive labor strike yesterday that rocked the UK and had some vile words to say about public employees. Frankly, he said, I'd have them all shot, speaking about the striking workers. I would take them outside and execute them in front of their families. I mean, how dare they go on strike when they've got those gilt-edged pensions that are going to be guaranteed while the rest of us have to work for a living. Of course, the man saying this, Mr. Clarkson, is a multimillionaire who makes his living on TV driving cars. Not only that, he's employed by the BBC, which means he collects his paycheck from the very same British taxpayers who went on strike. So maybe he shouldn't be calling for the murder of the very same people who write his paychecks. That's very, very ugly. At the very least, that's very, very ugly. John Maynard Keynes, back in the 1930s, wrote a paper called On the Economic Prospects of Our Grandchildren and talked about how at some point in the future we would become a leisure society, that we would be seen as productivity continued to increase, and particularly if population didn't radically increase along with it, that the value of labor would rise to the point where people would have to work less for the same income. And you'd have the 30-hour work week. I mean, we went from the 70-hour work week in the 19th century to the 60-hour work week to the 50-hour work week in the early 20th century to the 40-hour work week in 1935. And we stayed there. 1967 was the peak. That was the point at which people spent as much time in leisure activity as they did in work. And ever since, largely since the Reagan administration, We have been going in the opposite direction. No more. No more income. And it just a couple of things here. In the Leisure Society project of the 1970s, there was this whole thing. It was characterized by, this is, by the way, from a piece by A.J. Veal called The Elusive Leisure Society. Fordism. Now, this was, you know, Henry Ford's concept of paying his workers three times what everybody else's workers were paid so that they could buy his car and they'd have some time to enjoy it. Social reformism. The idea of leisure participants as clients of leisure professionals. In other words, there'd be a whole new class of jobs opening up of helping people use leisure time. Public leisure services and participation and leisure shock associated with affluence, optimism, and progress. Where has it all gone? It has all gone to the top 1%. And you wonder why Occupy Wall Street is out there? I don't, frankly. So, anyhow, John in Huntington Beach. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I just want to bring up something and see what you think about this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, about 1980, about the time of Reagan, there's also something else that started happening. And I would say that was the onslaught of the computer revolution. Because up until then, you know, you have progressing in technology. And as machines, I guess, commodified blue-collar labor and made it easier and drove down wages, because you didn't need someone really strong to build something. You could have a machine do it.
Mm-hmm.
People moved to white-collar jobs that were more educational-based, intellectual.
Right.
And that's where the wages were. So you had a point where people were getting higher wages with intellectual jobs and were benefiting from the commodification of blue-collar manual labor. But I tend to think that progress doesn't stop. And machines and technology have progressively gotten smarter and are now commodifying intellectual jobs and driving down wages. The internet has also made, unfortunately, easier for large corporations to ship jobs to places like China to take advantage of slave labor.
That's the magic bingo, that's where the leakage is. If we didn't have international trade working the way it is right now and our manufacturing jobs were still here in the United States, you know, I mean, just in the last 10 years, we've had 45,000 factories close in the United States. Those are not factories that closed because nobody wanted to buy their products anymore. Those are factories that those jobs moved overseas. Okay, so A, there still could be and should be a manufacturing base to the United States economy. It'll look different, and individuals will be far more productive, and they'll produce more things and, you know, with fewer people, but it's still there. And secondly, the intelligence, the information technologies, you know, the people using computers when they used to use paper and they used to use filing cabinets and whatever, you know, to do things, or architects using CAD/CAM machines instead of using, you know, pens and protractors and compasses. All of those things, yes, they're becoming more productive, but along with that productivity, up until the 80s came higher wages. And
but
what has and my point is that it had that continued to this point, that we would right now have a leisure society, but instead what we have is we have a top 1% that is the leisure society, and we have the 99% that's screwed.
I don't disagree with you. I do think that large corporations tend to create technologies that they tend to commodify pre-existing industries. Most of the great innovation, like Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, it wasn't IBM or Hewlett-Packard that created the first PC in 1978. It was two kids in the garage.
Right.
And the great innovation and the truth that create tools that people really need are small companies. Large corporations just go where they can do it the cheapest.
Right.
Steve Jobs said something once where what happens to these companies, that the salespeople end up taking them over,
and the bean counters
get marginalized.
Yeah, and the bean counters, and that happens to Steve Jobs' own company, which manufactures most of its
absolutely.
Stuff in China, and you know, which is ultimately so ironic. But and that's the leakage, and I'm an advocate for closing the leakage, because you know, with 7 billion people on planet Earth, there's no way that you know, I mean, there's an unending supply of cheap labor, competitive cheap labor.
True.
But that said, if we could, and every country should, by the way, every country should become self-sufficient and should have its own manufacturing base and should have, you know, and then the trade, basically between nations becomes, as Adam Smith envisioned, you trade for what you don't have domestically. So you trade for the minerals that you don't happen to have in your own soil. You trade for the resources that you don't happen to have, and you supply other people with things that they don't happen to have. And, you know, the classic example from Wealth of Nations, as I recall, was wool and cheese and wine. You know, that you've got one country, presumably France, where the growing conditions were perfect for making wine. You've got another country, presumably northern England, where you've got sheep and goats and they make good wool, and you've got another country, presumably southern England or maybe some other part of Europe that produces a lot of milk and cheese. And so maybe Switzerland, who knows? But none of those three countries can produce all three things, and so now you have a reason for international trade. Well, that makes perfect sense. But if you've got instead all three countries capable of producing all three things, and they begin competing against each other in an open marketplace, then basically what you have is the setup for monopoly, where whoever has the deepest pockets and can drive all the rest out of business by undercutting their prices until they're flat out broke and busted will end up controlling those three industries, and there will be no other industries, and, you know, subsidiary industries, feeder industries, and which is where we're at now.
I agree with you. I just think that, you know, the tools and technologies that we make, you know, could exacerbate this or help solve it. And I do think that a lot of large companies, they tend to make tools that commodify existing industries.
Yes.
And you have to think that a lot of these apps, while they're wonderful, do reduce the wages of people.
I'm not so concerned about that. I really think that if we were enforcing the Sherman Act as we had done up until 82 and Reagan stopped doing that, and we just said, you know, there's a certain size that you can't get larger than. You can't acquire 150 companies and become that big. You have to have 150 competitors. You have to have competition in the marketplace. That we would have a stronger economy. Thank you for the call, John.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So how do we create a leisure society? Is it even possible any longer?
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Well, maybe it's coming to Los Angeles. The National Field Director of MoveToAmend.org, one of my favorite organizations, Caitlin Saposi-Belknap, is on the line with us. Caitlin, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tom. It's so good to be here again.
Thanks for joining us. Move to Amend has big news about Los Angeles. Tell me about it.
We're so excited and proud of our local group in Los Angeles. They have been working hard, and the city council in L.A., on Tuesday, is going to be voting on whether they support a resolution that calls on Congress to amend the Constitution to clearly establish that only living persons, not corporations, have constitutional rights, and that money is not the same as free speech.
That corporations are not people and money is not speech. That's my mantra. That is brilliant. Now, Caitlin, how did this come about?
Well, actually, our group in L.A. was going to the neighborhood councils in the town and working to get them to pass resolutions, and one of them did and forwarded on to the city council.
Mm-hmm.
And the plan had been to go to several neighborhood councils, but actually a council member was so into the idea that he picked it up and said, yeah, we could do this at the city council, but he wrote a resolution that, you know, he wasn't versed on this issue. He wrote a resolution that was just about overturning Citizens United,
right,
which is important, but as the listeners of your show know, corporate personhood goes back well before 2010.
Right.
And so our LA group leaned on a subcommittee of the council and packed a subcommittee meeting and got them to amend the resolution so that it would be more complete, more systemic, and now it's before the city council as a whole.
That is great. I know that there are, you know, a few other people out there and a few other groups out there who are saying, oh, all we have to do is just, you know, roll back Citizens United or just get the money out of politics or something. And that sounds nice, but that's like putting a Band-Aid on a cancer. We need to cut the whole thing out, which is the idea that corporations are people and that money is speech. And that is going to require a constitutional amendment. And Caitlin, what We're talking with Caitlin Soposi-Belknap from movetoamend.org. Caitlin, what can our listeners on KTLK in Los Angeles or who are hearing us on Sirius or XM or Dish Network or DirecTV or whatever in the L.A. area do? And what can our listeners in every other city in America do to follow the example of L.A.?
Well, first for L.A., we really need folks to contact the L.A. City Council right now, tomorrow and Monday, to get the word out, let them know what you want them to do. So if you go to movetoamendla.org, right there on the front page is a list of your city council members and their email addresses and their phone numbers, and you can contact them and let them know that you want them to support this resolution for LA to become the first major city to pass a resolution like this. And there's also a form that you can fill out to let us know if you can come to the meeting on Tuesday at 10 a.m. and be there. We want to pack the room. And our folks at LA Move to Amend have been doing a great job getting the word out. They have tons of organizations on board. I just want to mention some of them. They have several the LA County Labor Federation, AFSCME 36. They also have Occupy LA. Common Cause has been working with us. The Environmental Caucus of the California Democratic Party, Move on LA. So a bunch of progressive groups are joining together, joining forces. So we need everyone to turn out in mass at 10 a.m. on Tuesday and let the council know that they need to pass this resolution. For everyone
first of all, the website is movetoamendla.org. And secondly, you actually got Occupy LA through a general assembly to endorse this officially.
Yes, to endorse the resolution.
That's a major big deal. You know, trying to get anything through those general assemblies, that's very, very specific, is a major project. I mean, I'm very impressed by that. Okay, so for anybody else in the country.
For anyone else in the country, what you can do is pass a resolution like this in your community. And listeners probably know, because I was on Tom's show before talking about what folks in Boulder and Missoula and Madison have done, where they put it on the ballot, so they actually had voters have the opportunity. So that just reaches so many more people than when you go to your city council. Although this LA, because it's so big, it's getting a lot of attention in the city and beyond. So you can go to your city council the way that folks in LA are doing, or even better, if you have the ballot initiative process in your state or your municipality, you can begin to collect signatures to get it on the ballot to put it before the voters. And this year, we've had hundreds of thousands of people who have had the opportunity to vote and decide what they think. And so to the caller who called in, I forget where he was from that you were talking to just before, about how do we reach these folks who are not engaged? Well, let's put on the ballot right in front of them and let them learn about this issue. And Move to Amend is happy to work with anyone. We have affiliates around the country. We're a grassroots Democratic group. So you can come on board as
in small D Democratic
community.
As in small D Democratic, not
yes,
you're not
exactly.
affiliated with
Thank
the Democratic Party.
Small D. For me, I don't even it's like I don't even think about it. Yes. Small
yeah, this
D
is,
Democratic.
Yeah, this is not party politics at all. In fact, there are many people in the Democratic Party who are freaked out by this.
Caitlin, we
just have a few seconds left. You want people in Los Angeles, our listeners and viewers in Los Angeles, to show up for the city council meeting. It's Monday at 10 a.m., is that right?
Tuesday
at 10 a.m. at the city council, and the city council is where?
I don't have that right in front of me, but if folks go to movetoamendla.org, all the details are there, your city council's information, so you can contact them, and then even if you contact them, please come to the meeting at 10 a.m.
Yeah.
On Tuesday.
To try to pack the room and show some solidarity, and this is absolutely great.
And if listeners don't live in L.A., but they know folks in L.A., please pass the word on to them, and then go to movetoamend.org, check out our local action toolkit. We have a model resolution that you can put on the ballot, and we have folks who are ready to help you out so that you can do this in your community.
Absolutely marvelous. Caitlin Soposi-Belknap, the National Field Director of movetoamend.org, and if you're in Los Angeles, movetoamendla.org. Caitlin,
thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you so much.
And keep us up to date on how it all works out. Tomorrow, Brunch with Bernie, Senator Bernie Sanders, at our national town hall meeting, taking your calls for an hour. And anything goes Friday. And don't forget, democracy begins when you get involved, when you show up, like Caitlin was just talking about. Tag, you're it. Occupy something. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.